Okay, Logan is actually imbued with special psychic powers that he has to actively control and repress.
Yes.
Sometimes they come out, and sometimes they come out via Skype.
This is the PC Gamer Podcast, episode number 170 for Thursday, April 2nd. Grateful to be back from GDC, the Game Developers Conference, last week. Sorry we missed you guys on the podcast last week. But we're very ready to give our take on all the news on all the news that the show produced, including the mysterious OnLive service. Will it destroy PC gaming? Is it the console killer? Will we make sensationalist statements about it, like every other mainstream media outlet?
It's the end of the world!
We'll also give a quick rundown of all the best and worst games industry April 1st foolery from yesterday. And we're very lucky to be joined by not one, but two developers from Relic here to talk to us about Company of Heroes, Tales of Valor. Add in a few listener questions in our playlist, and I think we got ourselves a podcast, gentlemen. I'm your host, Evan Lottie, and I'm joined by reviews editor Dan Typhoid Stapleton.
I wasn't patient zero, I'll have you know. That was Norm. Norm brought this down on me.
Yeah, Norm infected everyone, unfortunately. We're also joined by Logan Lotoro Decker.
Hello. Lotoro, I can get used to that.
How we're pronouncing it? Okay.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Kind of makes you sound like you're just a big Lord of the Rings fan, but... We'll explain
that's
this.
That's a freak wearing a cat hat.
Yeah, we'll explain this later. Don't worry, guys. We've also got our resident intern, Josh, who has seriously played about 13 different games in the last 24 hours, August.
Yeah, it was fun. Walks down memory lane.
And as always, podcast producer Andy Bauman.
Hey, guys. Excited to be here, as usual.
And welcome them to the podcast, two gentlemen behind still PC Gamer's best rated real-time strategy game at 96%, Company of Heroes, and the forthcoming standalone expansion to Company of Heroes, Tales of Valor, Tim Holman, the senior producer on the game, and Brian Wood, the senior designer. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello, how you doing?
Doing great, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Absolutely, really glad to have you here. So before we attack our usual slate of news and all the stuff from GDC last week, I want to give Tim and Brian just a chance to introduce Tales of Valor for you guys that aren't familiar with it yet. So what's kind of the 60-second rundown on what Tales of Valor is about and what's going to bring?
Okay. Well, Tales of Valor, we really wanted to broaden the experience, so we wanted to do an even mix of single-player campaigns as well as a lot of multiplayer enhancements. For the single player, we've taken a new direction with our narrative design and put the player in control of fewer units, but with a lot more tactical action. And in the multiplayer modes, we've expanded it with several new game modes, which we're calling Operations, which are unique gameplay modes in the multiplayer arena, but then also adding new toys to our regular multiplayer slew, as well as new maps and lots of new features there. So it's really just more, merrier, and I think this one has probably more explosions than ever.
That's always a good thing in our book. Absolutely. Yeah.
This really isn't more of the same though, is it? And I've been playing it. It's pretty different.
It's very different. Like I said, you know, with the single player campaign, you know, we've done the big, you know, build up bases, gather army, go attack kind of modes, but we never really got a good sense of the narrative design. So for this one, you know, as you played, have you had a chance to play through all three campaigns yet?
I have, yeah.
Okay, so. Yeah, so Tiger Ace, you know, yeah, there you're just in command of one single tiger with that's very upgradable, and then Causeway puts you in command of two squads. Is there storming the town of Kokanee? One is packed with Thompson machine guns. The other one's packed with recoilless rifles, so it makes for some good infantry tank hunting combinations. And then Filet's Pocket is probably the most intense, defensive oriented scenario that we've ever designed. I haven't been able to complete the whole thing and hold all the bonus objectives myself yet. So it's a hard one.
One thing that's kind of struck me on this is that it seems to have incorporated a lot of ideas from Dawn of War 2 in terms of almost, or I guess, completely eliminating base building and really minimizing the resource collection.
Well, I can answer that a little bit. There's a lot of cross-pollination, as I'm sure you can tell, with our teams, but we didn't necessarily intend to copy some stuff from Dawn of War 2. I think just the comparisons happen because they happen, the games happen to be released around the same time. I think you'll notice that some of our missions in the original Company of Heroes didn't have the base building. We wanted to look at those missions and say, like the Carentan missions, for example, those were really focused on, some small squad tactics where the player was controlling fewer units. At least that's true for Tiger Ace and Kokanee, or I'm sorry, the Causeway campaign. So it just so happens that, it's like, hey, let's try and see, if we can try to focus the attention, from the player onto certain aspects of the gameplay without, keeping the base building in there to confuse things a little bit. Because it didn't really make sense to go have Tiger Ace and say you have to build more tigers from another base because the whole story and narrative wasn't really driven around that type of gameplay.
It also seems that you've beefed up the stats on a lot of these units. They're almost like super units in a lot of ways. Sometimes I felt like I was almost in god mode.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely with the upgrades to the units, particularly with the tiger. I mean, by the time you get to the end, and if you've done everything in the game and you have the maximum command points, yeah, that thing's a real lethal weapon of war. But also, that's really what we wanted to create was these units that are these scenarios and these actual stories where, one unit or a handful of units, against all odds, just really took the fight to the enemy and did amazing things. So, in terms of the comparison with Dao 2, the closest one we both teams kind of reached independently the thought of, well, fewer units allows for, more tactical or a more focused tactical gameplay. For Dao 2, whereas they focused it more in the roles type aspect and a lot of RPG elements of upgrading individual stats and collecting different loot, the Tales of Valor team really arrived at that more along the lines of wanting to tell a tighter narrative.
And so for the multiplayer modes, the operations, what was kind of the inspiration to do that? Because these are almost like they feel kind of like what you typically see in a really ambitious mod, where people kind of shuffle around the game rules and make a different gameplay mode out of it.
Well, we felt that there was, there's this element of people really know Company of Heroes, classic Company of Heroes, and they really enjoy that mode. So this was we wanted to say, hey, let's kind of turn things around a bit, try out some different ideas and see, what people really enjoy, what they like playing to some degree. So that's kind of how Operation Assault came around. On the other hand, we looked at Tiger Ace and we said, this is really cool. People really like, being able to have this really kick-ass tank that they drive around that they can upgrade and use with direct fire. And that kind of spawned, the idea for let's bring this to multiplayer because it's too cool not to have into a multiplayer mode. So, it didn't really fit in traditional Company of Heroes, but I think that's how Panzer Krieg came about.
So with Operation Assault, do you want to give people a brief outline of what that is? Because it's very different from even the other two modes.
Yeah. Brian, go ahead.
So Operation Assault is basically you've got two sides going head-to-head in this kind of trench, heavily entrenched battle where you've got mortar bunkers and MG&S, and you take on as a sole hero on the battlefield that's kind of leading your troops into the enemy in placements. And your goal is basically to kind of make your way through their entrenched positions and, take out their MG bunkers, take out their mortar bunkers, and kind of nail the enemy's HQ and destroy it. So with that, you kind of have, like Panzer Krieg, you have some similar capabilities where, there's no base building. You're just controlling one unit. You can kind of change what sort of role you have within the game. So you can jump around between a sniper or a commando or an engineer type, depending on, how you want to play the game. So, and then there's also veterancy leveling up capabilities that go along with that.
Right. And how come you didn't do the same kind of thing that you did in Panzerkrieg, where you, there's like the RPG skill tree, and in this one you just decide if you want to beef up your weapons, your armor, or your grenades, rather than gaining new actual abilities.
That was several reasons. One of the big ones was just the number of heroes that we had in there. We want to be able to expand upon these gameplay modes as we go along and release future content. One of the main reasons was with too many abilities, and with that large scale battle, we really wanted to focus on the actual push towards the enemy line, right? Whereas Panzerkrieg is the tactical coordination with three tanks. This is about three people taking part in a much, much larger battle. So we wanted to make it just a little more focused on just that, and so decided to give those fewer areas of upgrade, but then give the player more roles to choose from.
Right, and an important aspect of that is changing your role in the middle of the battle. Like, you know, if we let you play all the heroes all the time and you have all those different commander trees, I think you would just have too much. You'd be a little overwhelmed by all those different choices within a single game mode. So we wanted to keep it focused and narrow so that, you know, really the strategy is about what type of class you play, to, you know, what you choose to play while you're playing the mode, as opposed to, you know, in Panzerkrieg, where you say, I'm going to play this tank for this battle, and I'm going to, you know, the strategy in that is determining how you upgrade your tank and what abilities you get as you play through it.
Right, because in Assault, I guess you have, what, six different hero classes?
Yeah.
Six or seven, yeah. So quite a few of those guys. So, and you can switch between them when you die. So like if you went out as a sniper and got your ass kicked, then you want to go back and come back as a heavy weapons guy. You can do that without having to respec your character every time. Operation Stonewall is probably my favorite because it is the most like Company of Heroes, like the traditional Company of Heroes gameplay, which is you know, I have a real soft spot for. I love that game. So it's kind of the holdout kind of mode where multiple waves of enemies come at you from all sides, and you're defending a town. And you can play that in co-op. So, like, what was some of the thinking behind that one?
With Stonewall, the idea is simply that we've got all these players out there that who enjoy playing Company of Heroes multiplayer and skirmish against the AI. And after a while, I think you can figure out tricks and, you know, patterns the AI puts forward to you. So we wanted to say, okay, well, we want to give something to those players who don't necessarily want to play against other people. And so we want to take, you know, all that scripting talent, all that special, special kind of content that we've created for the single player missions, and move that into a cooperative experience that's somewhat dynamic, but it's also very, very difficult. We're basically saying, hey, we know you guys have been playing the game for 2.5 years, so here's some really hard mode that you really can sink your teeth into, and it requires, you know, a level of cooperation.
Yeah, the inspiration for this mission really came behind Mission 3 and Mission 4 in the original Company Heroes, when the player defending Carentan with just that handful of paratroopers. And that increasing wave of difficulty just made for a really good single-player experience. And doing a co-op mode of that was probably the best thing that we could do to kind of recreate that more traditional experience with that increasing intensity.
Now, does the intensity of the attack scale up as you get more players in co-op?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the number of attacks per wave increases, and we actually modify the difficulty depending on how many people are playing.
Yeah, I've only played that one single player so far. I'm about to Shanghai Josh here into playing with me, but right, that's what we're doing right after this podcast, actually. I was able to beat it after a couple of tries. It was mostly trying to figure out that the new way you unlock abilities and unlock new troops that threw me off the first couple times through. But once I figured that out, it's challenging and it's interesting. So good job with that one, guys.
Awesome, thanks.
So something I'm always curious about is sort of the research that goes into World War II games or war-based gaming. I don't know if you guys made a push for that since you already have experience with it for Tales of Valor, but for example, did you drive a Tiger tank? Did you go and see one fire? Is that stuff kind of even available to you guys? Or
no, I really wish we could have done that, but unfortunately, no. We had to rely on books and videos. But if you know of anyone with a Tiger tank that would like, you know, like to rent it out for the afternoon, let us know.
Yeah, I always wonder whether you guys or Gearbox are the bigger World War II buffs. Because those guys for the Brothers in Arms games went to Europe. They went nuts, and they also spend a lot of time at shooting ranges firing off those guns. But I know I've visited you guys a few times, and I've seen like your extensive libraries of research material, and neither of you guys mess around.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not too many places in Canada where we can go shoot a bunch of firearms.
Well, you're not that far from the border. You can go to Washington State.
Oh, yeah. There's some fun ones down there. I remember shooting decal in the deserts of Nevada. That was fun.
Nice. Yeah, we always encourage foreigners to come over and shoot our guns.
You know, I always talk to talk about going to Europe and taking a trip, and my wife is always kind of like, I don't know if I want to go, because all you're going to want to do is go to Normandy and see all the bunkers and all the cool history stuff there. And she's like, kind of want to go see some of the other cities and do some of the other cultural stuff. So,
cities?
Yeah,
what other cities?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, everything's in Normandy and, you know, Denmark, right? So.
So Brian, this is your first round of senior designer, right? I know before with Company of Heroes, we've been talking to Josh Mosquera, but I guess he's at Ubisoft now, right?
So, as I guess it's technically I'm lead designer. I didn't want to be like too specific about correcting you guys, but yes, I have. But on the other hand, I've worked on the original Company of Heroes. I worked on Opposing Fronts. So I'm very, very experienced with working with Company of Heroes, and have been with the development team for a very long time. So it's very true to my heart, and I love the franchise. And I've definitely learned a lot from Josh, and have carried on kind of that tradition of saying, okay, you know, it's about the soldiers, it's about real war, real warfare. You know, we're telling the story of these soldiers in the battlefield. We're not kind of taking the commander's perspective. So that's always, you know, always true with everything that we're doing. And I believe that's still true with Tales of Valor.
So out of curiosity, just how big of a thrill is it for a designer like yourself to go from being like an associate designer on a project to being the lead designer on the next one?
You know, I mean, I have to admit it's a little scary, but at the same time, it's like, it's also good because I have this huge fan base and there's all these people who love Company of Heroes. And so we've got a really nice vision. Plus I have, you know, we always say this, we have a great, great team of designers working at Relic who have a ton of experience doing all the level designing and scripting and multiplayer. You know, plus we've taken a lot of designers out of our balance group, and they come in with new, fun, fresh ideas. So it's a little bit daunting, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of history here and a lot of talent that you can depend on. So,
yeah, you guys are one of my favorites. So, you know, keep it up.
Awesome, thanks.
Yeah, and getting back to the story a little bit, I mean, one of the things I loved about the first Company of Heroes is sort of how seamlessly the story transitioned. I mean, that opening sequence where the CGI video, I guess, transitions directly into the gameplay is always pretty memorable. But just the way, there's really no loading screens between those cinematic bits and the gameplay itself. But with Tales of Valor, the way I understand, there's you are controlling German forces and you're trying to tell their story as well as the story of those soldiers. How much of a challenge was that for you guys, and how do you tackle it?
So the story, the specific campaign, well, I guess we're talking about Tiger Ace and Filet's Pocket. We generally, I think when we focus on the soldier story specifically. So when we looked at Tiger Ace, we really wanted to say, okay, this is a story about a guy who's a Tiger Ace and he leads his crew in a battle, but it's really about the crew and how they fight in battle, how they work together and what do they say on the battlefield. And, you know, because they're enclosed in this big, you know, metal box, and it's got to be really scary when all you're doing is driving down the road and you just have to rely on the guy above you in the turret to take out the target. So while, you know, there's still Germans, they're still, you know, they fought for the Wehrmacht. They're not necessarily Nazis themselves. They, you know, they were battles on the field and they have the same sentiments that just, you know, the Americans had too. They're fighting for their, you know, for their country, land specifically. I mean, I know it's kind of a minor point, but I think it's important that these guys are, you know, a lot of the guys were normal and and just average Joe, just like all the Americans and British in the army too.
I'd say one of the things we really try to do, you know, obviously the heavy political topic, you know, that period of time and how the two sides interacted, but with this, you know, as Brian was saying, it's really about the soldiers. We don't focus on the larger aim of the war, particularly on the German side. Obviously, we're very sensitive to that topic. It's something that actually we work pretty closely with our office in Germany, and with the review board over there. One of the things that they've always admired about the game is that it does really just focus on the soldiers. And oddly enough, we were the only game in Germany that were allowed to have actual blood in it, simply because we do take that perspective.
In Flay's Pocket, in particular, like the emphasis is really on the commanders just trying to keep their guys alive, right?
Yep.
It's got nothing to do with furthering the cause of the Third Reich or anything like that. It's just, you know, trying to keep their soldiers from being killed.
Well, and the interesting thing, the reason we picked that particular story was we were looking at going, I wanted to investigate, say, what keeps a soldier fighting when you're surrounded, you're at the end of your rope, and you're just there. You have to hold, you know, this line open. You know, what keeps you motivated to keep continuing on as opposed to just saying, you know what, I'm gone. You know, we're losing this. The entire country is losing the war. So it's – and, you know, it always comes back to they're there to help – you know, get as many of their fellow soldiers out of harm's way as possible. So,
and you guys have done this successfully in the past with opposing fronts. You were able to tell the German point of view without getting a lot of criticism for being, you know, Nazi sympathizers or anything like that. You know, it was very, very well done without offending anybody.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, we didn't really get too many comments about that. So, other than, yeah, I think we did a good job. We have to be careful about, you know, what we choose and who we choose to portray. So it's always much more difficult than doing the Allied side.
Yeah, when you're dealing with subject matter like that, not getting too many comments is a really good, a really great achievement.
All right, and while we have you guys here, actually, we did get one question from our listeners. We wanted to point in your guys' direction just to see if you can give them an answer. Andy, can you cue that up?
Hey there, guys. Tom here, also known as Frost. And I just had a quick question for you guys regarding the Company of Heroes expansion, Tales of Valor. I've always been really fond of the infantry combat in the original Company of Heroes and in opposing fronts, but it seems like essentially whichever player manages to get to the tank stage first will win the game, or at least that's been my overall experience. So my question is, are tanks a little more balanced, maybe a little easier to take down with infantry in this new expansion, or are they still sort of, you know, huge juggernaut powerhouses like in the previous iterations of Company of Heroes? Looking forward to hearing an answer. Thanks for your time.
We've actually spent quite a bit of time. We just released a huge patch where we spent a lot of time working with the community to look at the balance of the game. Overall, because I know it's always an ongoing process, and it's never, you know, you're always going to make somebody a little frustrated with what you do. But overall, I think the most important thing to point out is, like, you know, with any kind of strategy game, there needs to be some sort of end game. And, you know, we love the infantry combat. That's actually why we haven't tweaked it too much with Tales of Valor specifically, in terms of, you know, new units, and abilities, because it works so well. The whole suppression, you know, mortar, anti-tank, you know, kind of combat system going on works really well. So it's important for us to make sure that as during the strategy game, there's always the end game, because you need to be able to win, and you need to have to be able to push the enemy, you know, over the line, I guess, if that makes sense, so that you can win and defeat them and end the game. Otherwise, you know, it can turn into a stalemate, which isn't necessarily fun either. So I think we're still keeping the balance pretty much the same with that regard.
Right, and you can take tanks down with infantry. I mean, it's just, I guess if you have like anti-infantry vehicles as well, you're pretty much screwed unless you've got something to take out those anti-infantry vehicles, so that then your anti-tank infantry can do their work without getting mowed down.
Yeah, I mean, if you focus your tech tree too much on the infantry side, you know, and even by choosing the infantry commander tree, It's not necessarily you can gimp yourself to tanks, but depending on how you're upgrading your commander abilities, you can simply make it more difficult. I mean, definitely with the infantry side, I always invest in several AT guns and at least get up to my Rangers before I'll go up to my artillery. Because if you invest too much in your artillery, then yes, you're leaving yourself open to a tank attack. The airborne tree as well, the paratroopers, once upgraded with their recoilless rifles, are pretty deadly to tanks. But yeah, to Brian's point, at some point, if it's one squad of riflemen against the Tiger, that the Tiger's going to take him down.
Right. Now, you guys did mention that there are some minor changes to multiplayer with Tales of Valor. It's the second, like the alternative armored car, right? That's like the biggest thing.
Well, we've added we're adding new vehicles to the game that basically you can swap out before you go in and play multiplayer. If that's what you're asking about.
Right. It's a new armored car, right, for each side?
Well, it's more than just a new armored car. We've got we've got a new tank. We've got a couple of armored cars for the allies. We've got some smaller cars for the Wehrmacht and Panzer Elite, but we also have a cool new thing called like a kangaroo, which the British can use to put infantry in. So it's a variety of new vehicles.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, like I said, we're going to be playing a bunch of multiplayer in a few minutes here. So I haven't got to play around with all those yet.
Yeah, for the Allied, in terms of a good new anti-tank addition, is the Hellcat, which replaces the M10. It's a little faster, a little lighter armor, but packs a little more of a punch. And try that one out. I think you'll have fun with that in terms of tank hunting.
Well, and I was going to say it just has some cool new abilities too. So,
right, but these are not meant. These are alternatives to the normal units. So they're not. It's not like adding something on it's just kind of a tweak to your side that you can make if you want, right?
Yeah, it basically works in the sense of like you before you go into a match, you decide kind of how you want to tweak your army a little bit, and it just depends on how you want to play the game. So, you know, the armored car that you were talking about, the allies have the Staghound, which they can use to replace their Greyhound. And while they may sound similar, they function differently in the sense the Staghound has different veterancy upgrades. It's got different abilities, but it's a little beefier overall coming out the door. So it kind of caters to maybe players who don't necessarily want to spend that time of upgrading their Greyhound specifically. But at the same time, the Greyhound can become more powerful if it's used really well. So it's still a viable unit. And we also want to increase the level of strategy just in terms of, hey, I'm going to include these guys in my armies. Why don't you put these guys in your army and we'll kind of do a combined assault. So there's definitely – we want to add that level of planning outside of a match as opposed to just giving you everything inside of a match and you having access to whatever you need whenever you want it.
Excellent. Well, Tim and Brian, thanks so much for being here with us today to sort of prime people for these details on the game when it releases next Tuesday. Can you share what the price point on the game will be next week and if it'll be releasing anywhere other than retail on Tuesday?
The price point US is $30. I'm not sure of the European price point. It's got to be pretty similar. The street date is the 9th, but it's also available through Steam and Direct to Jive and several other ESD vendors. Complete list, I don't know off the top of my head. I think there's over 13. But so if you can't find it in the stores, look for it online.
And actually, in the spirit of having both of you here, we wanted to revisit one of our segments that we did a few podcasts ago. We had sort of a PC gaming audio quiz. We did it with shooter weapons before, but...
Uh-oh.
Yeah, since we're on the topic of real-time strategy, we thought we'd pull together a few classic games and see if you guys can maybe name the specific units from these games as they speak their slogans, I guess you could say.
Anyone got some Jeopardy music queued up in the background there?
Yeah, exactly.
Sing, Josh, sing.
Yeah. Do. I don't have a list of the games in front of me, but do we have four of them or five of them, Josh?
Four of them.
There's four, and I have the names of the file names, so I can't play along. But I'll just start playing them, except for this one. I don't know what this one is, so maybe you guys can help me out. So here we go.
Ready for battle.
Let's share the names of the games first. That'll be helpful, at least. It's
Age of Empires, Company of Heroes, StarCraft, and Sins of a Solar Empire.
Okay, well, the first one was Sins of a Solar Empire, I believe.
That is correct.
Ready for battle.
Yeah.
That's the TEC Cole Battleship.
Yeah, I played it. I didn't play it all the way through. Good game. You know, of course, when we all played it, we're like, let's do another Homeworld, but yeah.
Yeah, get on that, by the way.
Yes, please.
We want to.
All right, next sound.
I don't have time to f*** around.
Oh, okay, I know. That's definitely StarCraft.
Oh, yes. That's the bike. That's the Terran bike.
Yep,
Terran Vulture.
It's the sort of almost the crackly low-res sound of it is actually very nostalgic.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah.
It's touching, yeah. You know?
Brings it back.
It's actually kind of hard to get those, though, because Blizzard does so many of them for each unit that, you know, it's hard to remember which ones go to which.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they've got the distinctive voice actors in there. You just know, you just recognize. So
Blizzard RTS is click on the sounds to hear all the sequences of dialogue that they have.
Yeah, going all the way back to Warcraft 1 or 2 when they started doing that.
Yeah, speaking of voice actors, I always recognize Steve Blum, is it, from Dawn of War and Company of Heroes, in your guys' games.
I'm trying to remember.
I want to say Steve Ballmer, but I'm not sure if that's right.
I like Cowboy as the main actor, so. Anyway, we got two more. Fire away, Andy.
Greaton? Mandatum?
What?
Yes.
Wow.
Need translation first. What was that?
Empires.
Yeah, okay, Greaton? I remember now.
Mandatum?
Yeah, okay, I remember now.
Yeah,
well, that's really
empires.
Strange hearing that out of context is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Any guesses to what unit?
Oh, jeez.
I have no idea.
That's throwing it down, man.
It's got to be the like the German peon, right?
Or yeah, it's just the female villager.
No, I think it's Greek. Isn't it Greek?
That's a Greek. Doesn't sound German.
Oh.
It sounds Greek to me from Age of Mythology.
Greaton? Mandatum?
I was playing as the Britons, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Just old Latin. English.
Old English.
Well, old English is a Germanic language, so it's kind of Germanish, I guess.
Yeah, actually, I must have forgotten, like, all the military units have the same voices when you click on them. They all sound exactly the same.
Well, and back in the day, I guess Blizzard probably were the first people to do that, to have, like, different ones for everybody. I could be wrong on that. Command & Conquer might have done it, too.
Well, there's one more, and let's see if you guys can guess it.
All right, men, time for the fighting.
That one's pretty tough. I don't know.
The guy's not messing around.
I don't know. I never heard of it. Jeez, sounds like an odd game. I don't know.
I'm just like picturing a guy with a watch that has like eating time, fighting time on his watch, and like TV time. Like those are the hands. There's no numbers or anything. Sounds like a fun guy. I want to hang out with him. You know?
Oh, that's of course the engineer from Company Heroes. I remember reading the character description. He's supposed to be a guy from the Brooklyn or the Bronx who grew up in his daddy's mechanics workshop.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah.
He only wants to fix cars. He didn't want to put up fences.
Yeah.
Nope.
Very good.
And he doesn't like mice either.
All right, fantastic. Thanks for joining us for that little mini pop quiz, I guess you could say, guys. And I guess we can say we're very successful. So
thank you very much.
Cheers. Yeah. All right, so tackling our little tardy on our topics from last week after we skipped the GDC podcast, but we're very ready to talk about this crazy what is it kind of service. Will it destroy PC gaming and console gaming simultaneously? Service on live.
Yeah,
what was that noise? Oh, it was PC gaming and console gaming being destroyed.
Is that what that sounds like?
Yes.
I imagined it would be louder. But
I'm sure there's no reason why the company would want to, make that statement in their press release when they're coming out. You definitely don't want to come out saying, oh, you know, we might get a few customers here and there. You know, if you're going to come out, you got to come out saying, ah, we're going to take over the world.
If it works, it's got a shot at taking over the world. I mean, when you think about it, I mean,
the thing is, it certainly won't destroy. I mean, you know, PC gaming as a whole, it's really another method of delivery, right? You know, for developers like us, you know, whatever platform or how we're pushing it out, we can make a game for whatever platform it is. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say that I have no doubt that it'll work in 5 to 10 years.
It's gonna take significant time for that amount of cable to be laid really across all the territories. There's still so many people on modems. It's eventually gonna happen though.
We should actually back up a moment and tell people what it is if they weren't following GDC coverage.
Exactly. If you missed the news, it was sort of the big announcement of GDC. There weren't a lot of other big announcements, but this new service called OnLive, going to be in beta this summer, supposedly announced this winter. It's essentially a cloud gaming computing service, subscription service in the way that GameTap is, except instead of downloading games, essentially OnLive is doing all the processing and computing power through their servers and then remotely distributing the video, you know, encoded and compressed to your monitor. So essentially it eliminates the need for users to have high-end hardware because they're doing all that work on their end with their servers. That sounds incredibly ambitious. They're saying at this point that you need, in order for like standard definition video, you're going to need a 1.5 megabit internet connection. For high definition 720p video, you need a 5 megabit connection. I've been trying to find, I mean, just for the purpose of our article, some statistics on how many people in the United States have that kind of 5 megabit connection available to them, and I haven't found out yet, but just taking a poll among like Maximum PC and everyone around here, it doesn't seem like we're really all quite there yet. So
that's, well, I mean, and even like with us, I mean, we're all pretty nerdy around here, so that's not a very good sample. I mean, like I have at home, I have a 6 megabit AT&T DSL connection, which, you know, it would be fast enough for this, and we're lucky enough to be within, you know, 50 miles of their, I think they're located in Palo Alto, California, their headquarters.
Yes. Yep.
So realistically, we would be in kind of the prime market for it. But I'm still not absolutely convinced that it would be great, you know, a great service, considering that A, you know, my internet connection is still a little bit spotty at times. I see dips every so often, and to be dependent on a very fast, very steady internet traffic connection to play a game is kind of a scary thought. I mean, if that was my only means of playing games.
And that would be different if like there was some, you know, offering where Comcast guaranteed you quality of service, right? And then partnered up with this company. But of course, I don't see that happening anytime soon because you're going to be pumping huge amounts of video, you know, over their network. I don't even know if they're going to like that, you know, or want to partner with these people. But yeah, I mean, because I have the same experience. I dropouts all the time. You know, it's commonplace.
One of the biggest barriers that a service like this really faces is geography, right? So you take a country like Korea, for example, where, you know, everyone's online, everyone's on fiber optic, but it's 60 million people crowded in a fairly small area, right? So, you know, when you do events over there, or if you do anything, if you support Seoul, you support the whole country. But then you go to the country like, you know, the United States, and like you said, you know, oh, if I live close enough to my hub or close enough to the servers, it's going to be good. Well, there's, you know, lots of, you know, thousands of miles of a lot of empty space in between the coasts, right? So you're going to have a hard time kind of reaching those customers in the short term. Europe, where bandwidth is a little more premium charged, people are going to be, you know, a little less apt, you know, even if they want to play a single player experience, to have to pay in some countries by the hour for that usage, right? They'd much rather just buy a disc. So one of the big barriers they do face is geography. Also the carriers themselves, for them to lay new pipe to be able to support all these users, that's, you know, several billions of dollars of investment on their turn. So will that happen eventually? Sure. But it's going to take some time.
Yeah, and with the geography question, There was an interview on Joystick where the CEO of this company was talking about that they claim that within 1,000 miles of one of their hubs, you'd be able to have a playable experience without a whole lot of lag, which you know might be a bit of a stretch, especially like we were talking about with mm-hmm. the you know even with a high bandwidth connection, it's a little bit spotty. But I guess Evan, you played it at GDC, right?
I did, yeah, and I was going to mention that. I mean, but again, that kind of is the fear, like with the service, that you'd have multiplayer type lag in single player games. I mean, nobody wants that kind of experience. But yeah, I got to play like BioShock and what else? Burnout Paradise, I think Frontlines, indeed, at GDC with OnLive with keyboard and mouse and their proprietary controller. And understanding, so I sort of treated it as like a beta product at this point, but understanding
well, it
that
is.
It's a, yeah, I mean, but understanding that, so that, I mean, GDC is a controlled environment. It's not open to the public. They're 50 miles away from their server bay. There was intermittent lag, but it didn't feel like unusual different lag. It just felt like kind of normal skippy lag, if that makes sense. And I mean, it played well for the most part. It felt like a normal game, and it was fun. And
yeah, it's definitely very impressive technology. I wouldn't have thought that it would be at all possible to do it with, you know, to have a game be that responsive.
Yeah, that's true. That is
on a remote server. I mean, even with like a ping of like 30, it would. I wouldn't have guessed it would be remotely playable.
Right. I mean, I'm looking forward. I mean, we're definitely looking forward to when the beta launches, doing all kinds of crazy stuff and trying to play Crysis on our netbooks and a Macintosh and whatever else we can do to try and break it. But
the other thing that kind of bugs me about this is that it's maxing out at 720p. You know, who's played a game at 720p outside of a console on their PC? Who's played a game in 720p in the last like 5 years? And it's that we've left that behind. You know, it just looks grainy now. So, yeah, I mean, unless I'm playing on a netbook that can't display resolution higher than that anyway, that would feel like a step down to me.
I totally agree, but again, maybe it's not for people that are looking for. I mean, again, depending on what their subscription prices turn out to be, are looking for a very deluxe, high definition experience. I mean, if they already don't have necessarily the hardware to run high end games, and they're just looking for a means of playing those games that they don't have access to, this might be it. And I for one like welcome more people to our industry. Just if hardware happens to be a barrier for them for whatever reason, Go for it.
I think some of the places they'll really see the benefit of this is a lot of the up-and-coming territories, such as Southeast Asia, South America, South Africa, and India, where a lot of their infrastructure is only now being laid or has been laid within the last couple of years. And so their first time through, their first time they're doing their infrastructure, it's better equipment, it's better lines, and there's not a lot of people there that can go out and afford a $4,000 PC, but they can't afford, a $10 a month or $5 a month subscription to the service to play older games.
The demo they showed that got streamed out of GDC, they had it. It wasn't so much a standard subscription service like GameTap that they were demoing. It was you can go on and you can rent a game for a few bucks and play it for however long, like a few days or whatever, for a few bucks. So I bet they're probably still playing around with their pricing models.
Have they said if they're going to have like new games right as they're released, or is it mostly older games like BioShock?
They've announced
too early to say.
They've announced partnerships with like Relic and EA and THQ. But that was actually something I brought up last week, that original content is sort of a missing hole for them. I mean, if they can bring that's another incentive for people with good hardware to take a look at least.
Well, hey guys, from your perspective, say something like this were to take off, would it not be more attractive for you guys to make a game that plays on a PC, plays with PC controls, but you don't have to optimize for dozens of different hardware configurations?
Well, that optimization pass that would help, that saves a lot of QA resources, saves some development resources. The biggest advantage to us, well, I mean, considering what they run it at and the resolution they run it at, we could probably make games off of our current technology for another 8 years for them, I think.
Sure, true.
Well, and there's also the benefit of that. Since the game is running on the server, we can at least guarantee the same experience to all the different players. And there's actually, I think it would be much harder to do all this sort of hacking that people do in games as as they do now. Like, it would make cheating a little bit easier to control and kind of guarantee that it's a little bit more of an even environment.
Yeah, that's true.
The biggest benefit really, though, is customers. You know, we don't know how many customers, you know, that would play the game out there if they didn't have to go buy a new video card or buy a new PC. But yeah. if they could just, you know, put their keyboard and mouse, you know, down on a table, plug it into their TV and go, you know, hey, that's, you know, it's great. It's more people playing our game. It's, we have, you know, more people on the servers and more people having fun, which is, you know, what we like to do. So,
well, it also,
yeah, if it brings more people into the industry, great.
Well, and I know that we all know that there's a big boom of notebook computers, and I think that may be part of their strategy, is saying, hey, look, people are playing on notebooks a lot more, and it's a little bit more difficult to play on a notebook computer because they don't quite have the, you know, the GPU and the video memory capabilities that a lot of the high-end computers have.
And if they do, they get extremely hot when you're trying to play big games, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so that's just kind of our initial take on it. Thanks for sharing your perspective on it as well, guys. I'm sure it'll be a continuing topic as they make some more press releases and we get our actual hands on it on the beta.
Yeah, if we can try it outside of a controlled situation, I'm sure we'll have a whole new take on it. So.
Of course. All right, so as is the tradition in the gaming industry, yesterday there's a whole mess of crazy press releases and original wacky content from Blizzard, I guess. I tried to make a list of all the stuff that was out yesterday. I don't think I got all of it, if you guys can chime in on what I might have missed. But from WoW, there was the Pimp My Mount customization feature. Diablo 3 announced a new class called the Archivist, which is basically a librarian. StarCraft 2 had some video footage of this giant mech called the Terratron, which is, I think it was like a Voltron-style mech assembled from all the Terran buildings, basically.
Yep.
It announced the World of Quake Live, their MMO. Dragon Age put out a trailer, had some people LARPing in it, which is kind of funny. Bethesda announced they're raising the price on horse armor, finally.
But everything else was discounted.
Everything else was discounted, that's right. Team Fortress 2's sniper class announced a new item called Jarati, which is basically pee in a jar. And Razer announced a Hellraiser game, and that they were partnering with Valve. Is there anything I missed, guys?
I was like sick in bed all day yesterday, so I kind of missed half of it. Plus, I tend to kind of turn off the internet on April Fool's Day. It's like,
I wonder why.
Yeah, it's like you can't even trust anything. It's like you might get like the best news in the world and just not believe it because it's April Fool's Day. So.
And yet I still get taken year after year. The one that got me this year, the one I mean, I guess we believe in the things we want to believe in because I believed that ThinkGeek really was selling a Tauntaun sleeping bag. I didn't know. You guys, I hope they still
That's
have
the one I
website.
Saw that I wish was real.
Yeah, you know, it's just it was this big fluffy Tauntaun sleeping bag, and then of course you put your head on the Tauntaun's head, and you zip it up, and oh man!
But what does it smell like on the inside?
Well, the viscera, you know, that was just like.
The coolest thing about it was the zipper was a little lightsaber.
Yeah,
that's awesome!
Wow,
that was the inside, magical.
On the inside, it probably smells like that squeezable bacon that they also. Like ketchup.
Lathered the inside with Crisco and shipped it.
Yep. Nice. Yeah, but I did hear that so many people said they were interested in it that they're now contacting LucasArts to see if they can sell.
I mean, I wouldn't mind having one around the house. Make it cool.
One for the whole family. Are you kidding? Yeah, one for everybody.
That's funny. I think I saw a couple things. There was one of the gaming sites put out a big trailer for Legend of Zelda real movie, which looks pretty ridiculous. I don't know if you guys saw the Killzone love story. That was actually pretty funny.
Did the Zelda thing have just some dork running around in like a Peter Pan outfit?
Yeah, well, yeah, that was the whole joke. It was kind of, you looked pretty real at the beginning. You're like, okay, and then yeah, you see the guy in the little green suit, and you're like, oh, okay, maybe not. So.
I really like what Blizzard did with the Archivist and the StarCraft II stuff, but, I mean, they created totally new concept art, new animations and particle effects and these little custom movies for these guys, and I was, like, trying to calculate how much development time it would take to make those things, and basically they're maybe putting us 1 or 2 weeks further away from their games because they're spending time on this stuff. I don't know. It's fun, but it's just kind of silly.
It can't take them that long. I mean, especially like for something like the Archivist. I mean, that's you know, somebody doing some paintings. They could have commissioned that outside of their normal workforce, or they could have had their guys do it just as something fun on their own which they probably do. I mean, and something like the Terratron probably took some more work because they actually had to make the model and do some basic animations. But even so, I mean, that can't take them that long. We did an interview with Blizzard's art director for this last issue, talking about the StarCraft units, because they had just done a major new art pass on them, and he was saying that it takes them a week or two to put together, or around a week to put together your average unit. So if they threw something together pretty quick, it would take a few days.
Even so, that means StarCraft II is a few days later, and that makes me upset.
This is the price we pay for quality comedy.
All right, so just to round out our podcast this week, I wanted to take a poll among everybody about what we're playing. It's sort of a little bit of a lull for new releases. We're looking forward to Company of Heroes next week, but in the meantime, just speaking for myself, I've been spending a lot of time modding Left 4 Dead for an article we're doing, and there's one particular map you'll of course hear about in our July issue, but it's called Hunter City, and it's basically parkour for zombies. It's a versus map, but you only play as hunters, and there's all this unique geography designed to teach how to do things like corner jumping and wall jumping, and it's very, very high skill and satisfying. Like, I just kind of jump into it, and I turn off all the game audio, and I turn on Pandora or something, and it's just a really satisfying and challenging experience, and brings back a lot of memories of playing similar mods and tribes and whatnot. So I've been having a good.
Otherwise, I guess if you didn't turn off the game audio, you'd just be hearing
yeah, pretty much. I got sick of that. So, but it's cool. I put it on our clan's Left 4 Dead server and got some people to join in, and makes it even more fun. So that's been a great time for me. How about yourself, Dan? Other than Tales of Valor, of course.
I finally got around to playing GTA 4, which I've finally got running at a fairly decent frame rate. After the third patch, it's running okay for me. Still not great, but okay.
Nice.
And I liked it a lot. I put probably 40 or 50 hours into it over the last few weeks. It kept me playing, although there were a few times with missions that were a little bit harder, and I would get killed a few times. I'd have to just keep playing over and over again, like the part leading up to that, which drove me nuts. Cannot for the life of me understand why they didn't just do checkpoint saves within the mission. Absolutely insane.
Agreed.
But other than that, great game.
That's been a problem with every GTA game so far, and it's always the bank missions that have the worst mission like layouts as far as the length of time you have to go from like lead up to action to dying.
Well, the bank mission actually did have an intermittent save. There were a few of them that did have checkpoint
saves.
Really? Bank mission, yeah.
Oh wow! Not on the PS3.
Yeah, on the bank mission, you would break into the bank. There would be it went wrong. Then it would start you out. You would
outside.
Go do the rest and get yourself killed. It would start you out just like after you emerged from the bank with your money. So that it was still kind of annoying because there was still quite a bit to go through, but
yeah.
that at least didn't make you drive back to the bank every time.
Absolutely.
Have you played around with the video editor at all? Because that's something that I really want to get into, I think.
I haven't because I turned off the video capture to improve performance.
Ah, okay.
Annie Bauman, go for it.
I got into Red Alert 3 after I beat Tomb Raider Underworld, so that's what I've been like diving into head first, and so far I'm just playing through the Soviet campaign. It's really fun.
Underwater Tomb Raider Underworld, remember that?
Oh, the last like,
go dead,
area.
Yeah, then those big sorry.
Yeah, that game is so good. Like, I haven't played a Tomb Raider game forever, and that kind of makes me want another one.
Yeah, that. Oh man, I loved it.
What's your favorite Red Alert 3 unit so far, Andy?
Either the Warhawk, or is that what it's called? The Twin Engine? No, the Twin Bird or whatever?
Twin Blade.
Twin Blade. And then also the big battleship that has lots of range.
You're talking about the Soviet one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
I think the Japanese one might outrange it.
Well, I haven't got there
yet. Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah. They're close, though. Josh Augustine, you've been playing every game under the sun yesterday.
I have. It has been pretty out of control. For the most part, though, unfortunately, I've been playing Merchants of Brooklyn for review and playing a lot of Battleforge, too. I love opening the little booster pack of cards you can get and flipping them over. It's just like buying the booster packs from the store. That's been a lot of fun.
So, Josh, you're saying that our optimism about Merchants of Brooklyn the other week was misplaced?
Yes. Unfortunately, I have to say so.
Is it, like, broken, or is it just not fun?
It's not broken. It's just not finished, I guess. So it's not like, yeah.
And you're not playing the alpha version that was accidentally
right.
released initially.
Yeah, because I heard about that, so I waited. I waited a few days, and I made sure it was updated on Steam. I waited, updated, everything was good to go. But it certainly feels like the alpha game.
Right. I played like the first 10 minutes, and the voiceover is just terrible.
Oh my gosh.
It's hilariously bad.
Yeah. So that's almost entertaining if that wasn't the only guy and the only voice like the entire game, but after a while it gets a bit old.
I have been rummaging around in the archives, replaying some of my favorite levels of all time for a story, which includes the wonderful, wonderful cradle level from Thief Deadly Shadows. I managed to get a copy of Star Trek: A Final Unity working under Vista, which is really sweet. And I'm also playing XCOM now, finally, and I'm trying to manage
really?
My anxiety. Yes. It's all that decision making, yeah. You know.
Did you consult a manual before you started playing?
No.
Oh, you're okay. That would cause some anxiety. Because that was...
I know, it was born in the age when one did not do such a thing. When you read the manual on the bus on the way home from the store.
Exactly.
You know, and you're like, oh, man, flip, 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 flip. Oh, flip, 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 flip. When I got MechWarrior 2, I think, at Fry's, you know, I went through every word of the book.
Right. XCOM UFO Defense is my favorite game of all time, but playing it without going in blind is crazy. You'll hate it. So you have to know what you're doing. Logan, I'll have to sit down with you and give you a quick
that'll
tutorial.
Probably be helpful, yeah, because I mean it wasn't so bad for me, but it was really demoralizing for my troops.
I imagine they must have taken some punishment.
Yeah, and I'm finding that I'm having to put the call out a little wider across the lands each time, you know.
Right.
But now that I hear that GTA is, you've got it working, I think I may actually start playing that now because, it was just a nightmare before, and I was just like, I'm not even bother. But that's after my tour of duty in XCOM.
So Tim, I'm not sure if it's a particularly extremely busy week for you guys or not, but if you've been playing anything else, please share it.
I picked up Resident Evil 5, played through first couple hours of that, obviously Tales of Valor, and then a lot of Company of Heroes Online, the one that we got going in China. I dusted off, I rebuilt a machine so I could play X-Wing versus TIE Fighter weeks ago.
Nice.
Yeah, I hadn't played that in a while, and that brought back some good memories.
What kind of machine did you set up for that?
It's old Windows 95, like 3 machines ago that I had to dust off.
That's fantastic. Do you have anything else you think you're gonna throw on that machine?
Oh well, I've gotta dig through storage and find some of my old discs. I don't know. I'll have to see what I find in my little treasure trove.
Yeah, maybe some mist.
I've made a pact that I've got to keep a Windows 95 or a 98 machine around just because there's so many great games from that era. Yeah, it's good to dust them off every now and then.
And I always love to go back to Planescape Torment. That's such a great story.
Oh, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The best RPGs of all time, definitely.
Now, hopefully, good old games will just continue to keep, you know, releasing these old games in you know, with DOSBox wrappers so that we can play them without having to have a whole separate machine lying around.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I fear for some of these old games because, I mean, I don't, like, for example, Star Trek, I don't even know I don't know if anyone knows who owns that anymore, because it was Interplay, and I don't know who bought Interplay. They just seem to have vanished.
Interplay is still around. They're still around. They're like, it's kind of a zombie.
They're around in the sense that they're at garage sales selling their licenses at this point.
No, they claim to be working on Fallout Online right now.
All right, see you in 2015.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, but that's what they that's what they claim.
But GOG is doing a great game, a great job, you know, pulling out some of these games. It's just amazing.
Yeah, hopefully LucasArts will jump on their bandwagon soon.
And yeah, Brian, go ahead if you've got anything else.
I've mainly been still playing a lot of Left 4 Dead. I'm still having a great time with that. I'm playing Tales of Valor, of course. And actually, we just picked up I've been playing some a DS game from GDC. I don't know if you guys are at the keynote, but they handed out whatever, Rhythm Heaven, on the DS. Which is, you know, kind of goofy. It's a little quirky. Actually, I've gotten back into playing some stuff offline. We're playing we got a Dungeons & Dragons campaign going. So
nice, fourth edition.
I'm doing some DMing for that, so that takes a little time.
It's always interesting to hear what developers play in their spare time. When we talked to John Carmack a little while ago, he made a big point of saying like he plays stuff with his son, Wii games and casual games. Because he always sort of, I mean, he's kind of one of the greatest engine programmers of all time, arguably. So inevitably, if you play shooters and action games and first-person games, he ends up critiquing that stuff, and he can't really focus on the experience itself. So it's always interesting to hear. Thanks for sharing, guys. All right, and I guess that brings us to the end of our longer-than-usual podcast this week. If you'd like to submit questions for next week's podcast, give us a call at the same number as always, 877-404-1337, extension 724, and send us and leave a message that's about a minute long. Or if you'd like to record ahead of time, zip us an email over to pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Tim and Brian from Relic for joining us this week. You can find Company Puro's Tales of Valor on store shelves next week in the United States for $30. For the PC Gamer Podcast, I'm Evan Lottie, and I'll see you guys next week. Thanks.
Later, Gators.
All right. Bye. Thanks for inviting us.
Somewhere in that busy schedule, you got to work in Homeworld 3, right?
We talk about it a lot. that we really want to do. Right now, the studio is just too full of projects. We literally have too much going on right now. But every time we I don't know. I really hope we start one up within the next year.
Me too.
I agree. I think it's way past time. You know, that's the reason I joined Relic. Was those two games, Homeworld 1 and Homeworld 2, Cataclysm. You know, even though it wasn't on my Relic, it was still a great game. Yeah. Such a great IP, but what to do with it, right? We want to make
games.
Sure. Yeah. we want to make sure when we do it right.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that is really our roots, right? That's the one we're born on.
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot.